This episode is sponsored by Grand Army, a neighborhood restaurant and bar in Borum Hill, Brooklyn. Visit GrandArmyBar.com or at Grand Army Bar on Instagram and Twitter.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Fomet About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Guzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Happy November 7th. I'm not sure what number episode this is, somewhere in the 180s. Does anybody know that here? No? No. Well, we're very excited to vote tomorrow.
Oh, yes.
It is a most important election.
It is the most important election.
The most important election. And there's all sorts of other stuff going on in the world. Locally, coming up, Mary.
What we got coming up?
You have one announcement. You want me to go first?
I'll
go first.
You do first.
No, you're already. Okay. Well, this weekend, Spider Bite is having a celebration out in Long Island. And we, as Fifth Hammer, did a collaboration with them. And they will be celebrating on Saturday, November 12th, from noon on all day into the evening. They've done several collaborations. They'll have 20 beers on, which is crazy because they're a small little three-barrel system. It reminds me of the brewing at 508 and Larry Goldstein makes some amazing beers. We're really happy to participate with him and celebrate his anniversary. I'll be coming straight from that right back to Brooklyn. Mary and I are participating for The Well in Bushwick. They're having their second anniversary, and they're going to have an insane list of beers, but they're also having a panel discussion on the beer scene in New York and things
Brooklyn
like
specifically.
Brooklyn specifically, how things have changed, and Mary and I are going to be part of this panel. I'm not sure what will be asked. But I know our answers are going to be awesome.
It's called Borough Brewing in the 21st Century, Reimagining the Neighborhood Brewery in Modern New York City. We're joined by a bunch of people. Sam from Other Half, Zach, Tony, and Pete from KCBC, Jesse from Inner Borough, Eric and Jeff from Greenpoint Beer and Ale, and Patrick Allen from Keg and Lantern Brewing Company. And the panel starts at 5. So if you want to come get that, it is free.
It's going to be a lot.
Yeah, stop on by.
Yeah.
Bushwick. Or wait.
Well, yes.
It's sort. East Williamsburg, Bushwick.
If you look at the map. And technically, we're in East Williamsburg right now, but this is still... Oh, sorry. This is still Roberta's of Bushwick. Here we are. Okay. But that's neither here nor there. On Saturday, November 19th, Brew for a Cure, an event in which homebrewers and local breweries will work together to help raise money for St. Jude's Children Cancer Research Hospital. All of the proceeds from this event will be donated to the charity. It's called Brew for a Cure. It's put on by Pope Wagon Brewing Company, which is really just a homebrew crew. They hope to open a brewery of their own one day. Brian Pope and Charlie Chuck Wagon Gotard. They are members of the Brewminaries, our local homebrew club, one of the largest local homebrew clubs. It's going to be held at Transfiguration Paris Hall from 1 to 5 p.m. You can get tickets. That's in Massbeth, yeah, in Queens. Loving what's happening in Queens. All sorts of things are happening in Queens.
On that same day, there's an event called Brew in Motion 2.0. It's a celebration of contemporary dance and craft beers. Three choreographers will present excerpts of their recent and upcoming works alongside four homebrewed beers from members of the Brooklyn Bruisers Homebrew Club. That's the same day, November 19th, from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Green Space in Long Island City. And you can search Brew in Motion 2.0 on Facebook for more info.
That's right. And if you're around Browery Lane right now, you can go to their meeting and talk to them all about it. It's the first Monday of the month, after all. And then?
Derek Dellinger, who we've had on the show a couple of times. He is the author of The Fermented Man and head brewer at Kent Falls Brewing. He is coming to Bitter and Esther's, that's our homebrew store in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn, this Thursday, November 10th at 6:30 p.m. And let's see what it says. It says it's free. But space is limited, so RSVP on their website. I think you can go to their website.
Bitternesters.com.
Yeah, website. /events. To learn more.
And that's that. I want to tell a small little story. In Hong Kong, a Temple Night Market, it's a really cool night market on the streets, all sorts of weird sort of Hong Kong cheaply made knickknacks and other things. And part of the scene is to barter down and deal with all these things. At the end of this long, long night market, which is totally awesome, there was always like, you know, it's usually at the end of the rainbow, there's a prize. And at this night market, the prize was a bunch of malodorous funk in the air from Wok's cooking stinky tofu, which has always been my neighbor, and I'd be always trying to avoid getting to the end. And then finally, I've gotten to be like a little bit more adventurous in my eating, and I was like, finally, I'm going to go back to Hong Kong, visit my family, and try this for the first time. And then they stopped doing it because Temple Night Market got really popular, and it was too offensive. The smell in the streets was too offensive, and they kind of shut it down. And I think some health ordinance, almost Department of Health kind of things, also stopped, put some more regulation on street stuff. Anyway, I never tried stinky tofu until the other day, coming back from a store.
Well, what is stinky tofu?
So, it's nothing to be trifled with.
All right. So I'm on a Wikipedia, of course. It's a form of fermented tofu. It has a strong odor. Basically, the traditional method is to prepare a brine made from fermented milk, vegetables, and meat. Can include a variety of things. And then that this brine fermentation can take as long as several months. I think that there are quicker methods to do it, in which fresh tofu is marinated in prepared brine for only a day or two, especially for fried or boiled cooking process. So it only adds odor to the marinated tofu instead of letting it ferment completely.
Ah. Well, when they fry it, and you know, it brings out that aroma pretty heavily. And we went to a place called Taiwanese Gourmet out in Queens.
In Elmhurst?
In Elmhurst. 84-02 Broadway in Elmhurst at St. James Avenue.
This is a Michelin-recommended restaurant.
Recommended.
Cash only.
Super cheap, though, but really authentic Taiwanese food. It was insanely delicious, except for the stinky tofu. It was not for me, but Mary loved it quite a bit. But,
yeah, man. Yeah. I ate them. That was my favorite thing. We got a variety of dishes, and that was my favorite thing, was the stinky tofu. They put it in, like, I think they put it with some fish sauce, maybe, though, as well.
That kind of got it.
And then some spicy, some hot sauce as well in there, and some pepper. And then there was also, I think, a fermented slaw that was on the side, that was really good when combined. But it has a very umami flavor. Like, Chris is like, what do you like about that? Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, not
so I have been eating vegetarian for the last few months. I'm flexitarian, so I will break it for special occasions, or special foods. But pretty much, I've just been on this vegetarian vibe. And I think that stinky tofu, it was very interesting because actually, it definitely has a spectrum. There's a different flavor at the beginning and then the middle and the end. It's a really complex food and flavor and aroma, and the whole ball of wax is just very complex. But I think you actually get that kind of dry aged steak flavor in there, kind of in the middle.
Maybe over dry aged steak.
Maybe raw steak.
Yeah. Anyway, suffice to say, there were no kisses for the misses that
Oh, speaking of strange foods, in preparation for the episode today, I taught a kombucha class last week. I have a lot of leftover SCOBY, and Kombucha Brooklyn, in their book, has a whole section about what you can do with your leftover SCOBY, and some of it is recipes to just eat the SCOBY straight. And it looks like a mushroom, and it kind of looks like it might taste like a piece of meat. Online it said it tastes like fresh squid, which I'm a vegetarian. I've never had squid before. I don't really want to have squid, but I decided to try it anyway.
I'm outnumbered, but trust me, I eat enough meat for the both of them.
So I sauteed it. I sliced it up. They say that fresh SCOBY is better. It's less chewy. So I sliced it up. I sauteed it with broccoli and teriyaki sauce. And I ate it.
And you ate it. And
what'd
you think
of it? It tasted a little bit like Chinese food that's a little bit going bad. It's like been sitting in your fridge for a while. And it's starting to go a little sour, because it does have that tangy flavor. Although I was reading on forums, and some people are like, I really like the flavor of it without cooking it. And they're like, it tastes like sour gummy worms.
We've had dried like jerky SCOBY
snacks.
SCOBY jerky.
Yeah.
I like those.
Yes.
Now, did you marinate? You didn't marinate it, right?
I didn't marinate it.
I'd be interested. I think that's something. Now I'm really intrigued because I have not done that yet. Mm-hmm. I have not
and
cooked
you guys,
with.
Do you have a dehydrator?
We don't.
Okay.
I used to have one, but I can't keep everything. But but yeah, now I'm intrigued, and I think that's really cool that you did that, Rachel. And I look forward to more.
Don't give up.
If you have their book, they have like a whole thing of recipes in the back that uses SCOBY as the main dish or as an appetizer. I'm sure some of those are like pretty good. I'm positive they tested all of them themselves.
Yeah, that's a good book. So speaking of kombucha,
it was in preparation for this episode because leftover SCOBY or just SCOBY in general. So we spoke a little while ago with Suzanne Lee, who's the founder of BioCouture and BioFabricate, which is a conference happening on November 17th about new technologies in fabric and fashion, including living fabrics and fabrics made in labs with living creatures like microbes and all that stuff. She's got a TED Talk. She was a TED Fellow. She was a Launch Fellow. She's all around badass lady. And she made BioCouture is clothing from kombucha. It's kind of like leather.
Cool. So we have a really cool interview with her that we're going to start right now.
All right, so we're joined now by Suzanne Lee, who is the founder of BioCouture and BioFabricate and the chief creative officer at Modern Meadow. How are you doing, Suzanne?
Morning. I'm doing great, thank you. How are you?
Doing good. So
let's start by just having you tell us a little bit about your background.
And, who you are, what you do.
Sure. Well, my background is I'm a trained as a fashion designer. Worked in the fashion industry. I've always been very interested in various kinds of innovation in materials and new ways of making things. And I guess I came to the world of fermentation when I was researching my book on the future of fashion, and really kind of taking a step back from the kind of intense, really super fast fashion system where we're constantly looking for what we're going to be doing, next season, to really asking a much bigger question was how else could we create something like clothing in, 50 years time, say, if you were to kind of take a step back and think about how we make materials, how else would you approach that? And I met a biologist and had a whole conversation that really kind of changed my life from that point forward.
A conversation about what?
Well, just, we actually kind of met in an art gallery. It was a completely serendipitous encounter. It turned out that he was a material scientist, but with a biology background. And he had a company in Scotland, in the UK, looking at taking waste crop materials. So the cellulose that you can extract from, weird-shaped vegetables that nobody wants to sell in the supermarket, and was combining all kinds of resins and things and making like an organic version of a carbon fiber composite. So we got talking about the work he was doing, and I said, well, I'm really interested in like new materials and how else we can make materials. And he said, well, instead of growing a plant like cotton in a field, you could actually turn to a living organism like a microbe, yeast or bacteria, to produce that same fiber for you. So you could ferment material rather than, extract it from a plant source. And so we got talking more, and I said, so what you're telling me is that I could potentially grow a dress in a vat of liquid with a living organism. And it just blew my mind.
That's fantastic. So talk about, how did you took that idea and you actually made it a reality. So walk us through a little bit of the process, where you started and kind of what you were experimenting with.
Yeah, so I mean, we just kind of immediately, we didn't stop talking. We were like, I was like, okay, so tell me more how I would go about doing that. And he said, well, actually, there's there's a very simple thing that we could try, which is, you know, there's a known recipe for something like a kombucha culture, and that will produce a mat of cellulose on the surface of the liquid. Let's experiment with actually focusing the recipe on producing that material. And so we just kind of collaborated together. He was in Scotland, I was in London, and he would come. He came around to my house, and we kind of brewed up some kombucha in the kitchen, and you know, set up all these containers, which ended up being, you know, all around my apartment and in my bathroom. So you can imagine the smell. And then David had it growing in his garage. And, you know, we would just kind of meet up and look at what we were producing. And then I just started experimenting and just drying that cellulose mat, the SCOBY. And, you know, it was just so interesting how, you know, a really good one would actually feel very leather-like. And so we were just kind of, you know, intrigued. We wanted to push it a bit further. We got some funding in the UK from the UK government to do a kind of art science project together. And that was really the foundation of the BioCouture project.
Cool. Now, I actually watched a video of you online of how you treated the kombucha, you know, the cellulose fiber to turn it into a piece of clothing. Can you walk us through a little bit about some of your processes or, you know, kind of some of the steps that you did to take this, you know, layer of cellulose SCOBY and create a piece of clothing?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, we were working with a recipe that had, to be honest with you, it's years since I've done it, so the exact ratios, I don't hold in my head, but my recipe is knocking around online. But what we did was we did notice that upping the sugar content did produce more flexible sheets of material. So we'd grow, I basically had a series of large plastic bathtubs outside my studio, which I kind of nicknamed my fabric farm. And we would be brewing kind of 30 liters in a bath and leaving it for around 2 weeks, at which point the SCOBY is kind of achieving a thickness of about 2.5 centimeters, you know, kind of an inch thickness. And making sure throughout the process that we were getting rid of air bubbles. So, you know, once the fermentation really gets going, to kind of dispel the bubbles, because the bubbles would result in holes or thinner areas. And then after 2 weeks harvesting it, you know, washing it out with cold water and detergents, and really drying it down on a wooden surface, so the cellulose adheres to the cellulose of the wood. And then once it's kind of air dried, working it like you would a traditional piece of leather, basically. So you can cut it with scissors or laser or whatever. You can stitch it. But we also found, you know, we discovered things like if you put two pieces of cellulose as the water is evaporating, they will bond, they will kind of knit together. So you don't actually need to stitch it. So you could create a 3D shape. You could also do that in the bath. So, you know, we created all kinds of pump systems and, you know, taking a 3D mold and getting the cellulose to form actually in the vat itself.
Instead of on top of the vat, you mean?
Yeah, instead of on top. But we, you know, the most, I guess the easiest thing to do was just growing large sheets of material and then cutting it and sewing it. We did so many things over various years, but you know, kind of putting dye into the vat as well, and being amazed that it still would grow through the dye. So, putting other you know, natural dyes in the vat, and so that it would grow in a color. You know, because one of the things that became apparent is, you know, this whole process could, you're producing a fiber. The fiber is arranging itself into a material. You can potentially arrange that material into a 3D form. And you could get it to actually grow in the color that you want, or with other things embedded in it. So, you know, if you drop things into that liquid, trap it under the surface of the initial layer, as other layers form, because they're forming from the bottom up, you'll create a composite. So anything that you drop in there floats, you know, as long as it sort of floats on the surface, as the cellulose rises from the bottom to the top, you know, that interface with the air, it will trap anything else in there. So there's just so much you can do. We found things like, you know, once all the sugar has been used up, it's actually very acidic. If you put the acidic material onto a board that has metal on it, it will oxidize. So it will turn, it will change color, it would go black. That was just something that we discovered as a mistake. You know, that was one of those kind of happy accidents. And the minute I realized that it would, you know, the oxidation would turn it black, it's like, well, that's cool, because, you know, black dye is a very intense chemical process. And if we can create a piece of black material without the need to add any dye, you know, that's interesting, you know, from a sustainability standpoint. So there was, you know, there was just kind of so much learning along the way, just through experimenting, really.
Very cool.
Well, that's really cool. I'm trying to think of, like, what I could do with that, possibly with all the SCOBY I have.
We're taking a short break, and we'll be back with more interview with Suzanne Lee for Men About It.
This episode is sponsored by Grand Army, a neighborhood restaurant and bar in Borum Hill, Brooklyn. Grand Army is a nice place to drink cocktails, slurp local oysters, and eat seasonally. We're open 7 days a week for dinner, and Saturday and Sunday we open a little bit earlier for brunch at noon o'clock. We're very, very happy to support Heritage Radio Network, just as Heritage Radio Network supports Grand Army. It's all about community, and that's how we feel about the radio and the bar. Visit GrandArmyBar.com or at Grand Army Bar on Instagram and Twitter.
So you wash it with just with a dish soap. So is it technically not still alive anymore once it's turned into clothing?
Not sterile.
Not still alive.
Oh, still alive.
Yes.
Sorry. No, absolutely. You'd be killing the organism for sure. I don't think that obviously you have to be careful when you're fermenting that you're not attracting other molds, because there's still a nutrient source there. So mold is a thing you have to watch out for. You need to wash it to get rid of that fermented smell. But that also serves the function of kind of killing the bacteria. They're no longer living if they're not in the presence of nutrient as well.
Right.
So what are you talked a little bit about this, about sustainability, but what were the advantages of using a studio or a lab grown material versus natural or man made materials?
Well, that's an interesting combination of words there, right?
You said
natural and man-made. Well, right. What I was making in my mind was both made
That's
by
true.
Me and natural.
Right. lab-grown versus more, you know, traditional,
like cotton
or even, you know, polyester. Rayon, synthetic materials.
Okay. This is my whole world, right? So it gets super interesting because, you know, I would argue that there's nothing natural about cotton at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the majority of the cotton that's worn by almost everybody on the planet is genetically modified, for example. You know, the percentage of organic cotton that's around is negligible. But anyway, we'll leave that to one side. In terms of more traditional fibers, you know, it's just one of efficiency, right? So a fermented material, the principal input is the carbohydrate source or the sugars. What I thought was super interesting about growing cellulose and gluconeacetobacter specifically is that, you know, you could feed it almost any kind of waste stream. So when we were looking at, you know, the whole process, you know, compared to any kind of traditional textile manufacture, you are potentially saving hugely on the amount of water that's required, certainly the amount of land that's required. You know, unlike, you know, crops in a field that, you know, they require pesticides and fertilizers and all of that stuff. You know, with petrochemical-based materials, you know, they're based on fossil fuels. That's a finite supply. So the one thing that we have, really, and this is kind of, you know, really why I'm, you know, in the whole world of kind of lab-grown materials now, is because I fundamentally believe that the future of materials will be something that relies on a living biological system. So whether that's yeast or bacteria or algae or, you know, fungi, mammalian cells, you know, all of these different living systems have the ability to produce all kinds of amazing materials for us that require less land and energy and water and so forth. So the fundamental principle behind why you would choose to grow a material like this is really one of, you know, much better use of planetary resources.
Absolutely. Now, there was a downside. I know you hinted at this a little bit already, but you have now moved on and you're working on other projects that are, have kind of grown out of this. But talk a little bit about what was the downside of this kombucha material, kombucha fabric, produced fabric.
Yeah, so contrary to, you know, I made a kind of quip at the end of my TED talk that it was, you know, the downside would be that I'd go out in the rain and the garment would fall
yeah,
apart. And, you know, and so then I was, you know, inundated with like a million people around the world saying, oh, you know, there's a great way to solve this. And it turns out that actually, you know, there were many, many ways to solve the waterproofing issue. The real issue was nothing to do with making it waterproof. The real issue is that at the end of the day, if you're producing a fiber like cellulose, which is still the most abundant natural fiber on the planet, you are going to compete in a market with other commodity fibers, cotton being the principal one. And, you know, with farming subsidies and all, you know, the whole kind of agricultural system as it's set up today, the true value of cotton, the value of cotton on the market is still incredibly cheap.
Right.
And to actually switch from farming cotton to building, you know, a kind of like a giant brewery for fermented materials, when what you're producing may not have any significant advantage over existing materials, it's just not something that is commercially viable. So while, you know, I had so many big brands, you know, coming to me saying, oh, you know, can we buy your materials, which was hilarious, because I'm like, you know, my tiny fabric farm in London. When you actually get into the numbers of how much they're prepared to pay per square meter for that material, the costs just don't work. So, you know, it's something that's amazing and fun to do at an artisanal level. But trying to make that work at scale, you know, when you have to produce millions or potentially billions of square meters of that same material, controlling quality and so on, you know, that becomes a really major biotech endeavor. And, you know, I subsequently talked to various people, you know, in huge companies like DuPont, et cetera, who have all kind of thought about this and failed to find a way to make the economics work. But the big learning for me was really that if you can, not that it just doesn't work, but that what you actually need to be able to produce is a material that does have high value in the market, right? So if you can make something like silk or leather, which are already expensive materials and reliant on, you know, traditional agriculture in some way, then potentially you can engineer those materials through your kind of living system to have new properties, whether it's like new performance or new aesthetics. Then people will pay a premium for that. And that's kind of what led me to work with Modern Meadow ultimately.
So what are you guys working on at Modern Meadow since you're no longer pursuing the kombucha clothing angle?
Well, we are looking at growing leather materials. I can't go into the specific technology, but we're producing the collagen protein that you find in animal skin or even your own skin. So, you know, our skin is made up largely of different types of collagen. And as a company, we're growing a pure collagen material and basically creating, you know, a new world of leather and leather-like materials without the need to kill an animal. So this is really kind of very much the forefront of biotech as it sort of meets the material world. So we're using some of the expertise and skills and science that have come through decades of biomedical research and are now applying them to grow materials which are animal derived, if you like, or they're animal free, but they have the same makeup that you would find in nature. It's just that we're bringing design and engineering to biology to create materials that have new properties. So it's a kind of amazingly exciting new world of materials that are going to be possible through biotechnology.
Definitely. Oh, really cool. Kind of a step beyond the lab-grown meat, also lab-grown leather.
Yep.
Oh, that's really cool.
So I know that Rachel attended a presentation that you gave recently.
At Eco Sessions at a, I think it was at the Wix Lab, Wix Lounge in Chelsea.
And that you had some other, you mentioned new projects that using microbes. Were there any, are there any other processes that you've encountered that use fermentation?
I know that you mentioned something about conductive acetic acid ink.
Oh, algae ink. Was it algae ink?
I thought it was a vinegar ink.
No, I don't think that was me.
Oh, okay.
We do have, at our event next month, we have some guys called Living Ink, who I think are from Boulder, Colorado, who are using algae, they're growing algae in different colors to replace printing ink, which is amazing. So that's basically using photosynthesis to grow a living organism that is, you know, expressing a color. There are, I mean, for me, one of the most interesting for a long time has been using mycelium, which is the rooting system of mushrooms. There's a whole kind of generation of mushroom material companies that are springing up. I don't know if you've come across any of them.
I don't think so.
Okay, so
there's a few.
There's Ecovative and MycoWorks. These guys are basically taking waste crop materials. You create a three-dimensional form, fill it with whatever, you know, your waste material is. So it could be oat husks or rice, you know, shells, even bits of fiber from the factory floor. And then you seed that with a mycelium culture. And the mycelium basically feeds on that aggregate and just grows all around it into that predetermined form. It's currently being used for things like packaging materials, furniture materials, and even MycoWorks are looking at creating like a mushroom leather material.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And it's still living also?
No, you basically bake it to, okay. You know, you heat it to destroy the organism. We're not yet at that stage where we're going to be wearing or using materials which are alive. But, you know, I think that we will get there in the decades to come.
Yeah, that would be super interesting to be able to wear a piece of clothing that could produce another piece of clothing. Or, I don't know, so, or have other functions. That's interesting. So if our listeners would like to learn more about what Modern Meadow is doing, you guys have a website. It's modernmeadow.com. And you mentioned you have an event. Are there any other events coming up that are open to the public?
Yeah, I mean, BioFabricate is totally open to the public. BioFabricate is really the only event that brings together all of these companies and researchers in this field. So the sole focus of BioFabricate is really materials that we can manufacture using different types of living systems. So, you know, we've got companies from, you know, doing yeast and bacteria and fungi and algae, you know, all of them are kind of there. And, you know, thinking about materials, the whole material world around us, so from what we print with to what we wear to what we sit on, how we build our houses, you know, what we put in our cars, all of, you know, those applications can be addressed by materials that we can grow.
And that is that on November 17th in New York City?
It is, yeah. It's okay. Parsons, the New School.
And if you guys want to find more about that, that's at biofabricate.co, biofabricate.co. Awesome. Well, it has been so nice speaking to you. This is a whole, I've listened and read several articles about other, you know, lab-created meat and some of this, these materials that you've talked about, but this is really informative and interesting to think about, especially from a fermentation, you know, from a, like a home fermentation perspective.
Yeah, now I'm thinking about cultivating my scobies in different shapes. Yeah. I don't know what I'd do with that, but it's a much cool idea. Yeah. And like putting beads and glitter in there. Yeah.
Thank you so much, and we really appreciate it, and we look forward to following you as you guys progress.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to hearing more of your shows. Thanks, guys.
Cheers. All right.
We had a really good time talking with Suzanne.
Yeah, I thought that was like one of the most fascinating interviews. And yeah, we learned a lot. I feel like we learned a lot, and it was a cool experience and really interesting what she's working on.
Yeah, some more things that you can do with your leftover SCOBY is, like Suzanne did, you can dry them out and... Since it's much like leather, you can use it as the cover of a drum. And I've heard that's a pretty good substitute
for
animal skin.
What do you think, Kuzme?
I think that's interesting. I'll try it. I'll get back to you on that.
We do have some drums at home that need covers.
Yeah, it's true. I got a couple drum frames that would fit. Actually, slightly smaller than what our SCOBY is in right now. We could try that.
Yeah.
Take a layer.
I always think since it's completely biodegradable, mm-hmm. and that's one of the things about, you know, water, you could write a spy note.
Oh.
So that would be kind of cool for your people that have kids, though, right? Because you could do some, like, super spy stuff with it. With little secret codes. I've been reading some British mysteries that are about the cipher in World War II. So I have codes on the brain. Anyway, codes in kombucha.
Codes in kombucha.
Yeah, that's what came to mind when we were talking to Suzanne. Anyway,
archived on Stitcher, iTunes, Heritage Radio Network, and encased in codes and
in kombucha and invisible ink.
Encoded in spirit, yeah.
I will say that I've been trying to do some experiment with some new fermentations, or kind of we're going to revive. We had let our sourdough starter die. Our kitchen's way too hot to bake, so we're going to revive. We're going to begin a new sourdough starter this week. I started a batch of kind of kimchi style daikon that I actually brought in. It's not quite ready, and I'm not happy with our Korean red pepper flakes. So I'm actually going to go to K-Town, which is on around 6th Avenue and 32nd Street.
It's around
there. 31st, 32nd, 33rd Street in Manhattan. There's an H-Mart there.
H-Mart's amazing.
Yeah, and I think I can get some different kind of Korean red pepper flakes. So I want to play. I'm going to start playing around with that. Daikon is in season right now. There's a lot of daikon at New York City's Green Markets.
Yeah.
I went to Green Market last Friday. Yep. And I also picked up some fresh cranberries from New Jersey. Turns out New Jersey is the third largest producer of cranberries in the country.
What?
And cranberries are a native plant to North America, which is pretty cool. So
explains
I haven't figured
Thanksgiving.
Out. Yeah, so I haven't figured out what I want to do. A fermented cranberry relish, kind of as an experiment to maybe possibly replicate for Thanksgiving, and then I also want to thinking about doing a fermented cranberry soda. So lightly fermented, maybe 1.5-2% alcohol. So I will keep you guys updated. I'm letting you all know so that I can be accountable and not slack off and make my ideas come to fruition. Anyway, hopefully you guys are exploring the fall vegetables that we are being blessed with right now. There's a lot that can be fermented. So keep that in mind, whether you have a garden or a green market.
Don't forget to vote.
Don't forget to vote.
If this goes a different way, we'll be talking all about Canadian ferments next week.
Cold weather ferments.
Yeah, right.
Until next Monday, ferment about it.
Ferment about it.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.